You're listening to BBC Radio 3. It's midday and time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
The abstract painter, Mally Morris, has long held a fascination for colour and light, and she's been exploring their possibilities in her work for more than 50 years. She was born in Wales and studied at the University of Newcastle, where the pop art pioneer Richard Hamilton was one of her teachers. He brought her and fellow students news of New York, which she says seemed as far away to me as the moon. Mally herself taught at a number of art schools. She was elected a Royal Academician in 2010. And last year, flags made from her work hung above Bond Street, not far from the Royal Academy, in a great riot of joyous colour. She currently has a major exhibition at the Icon Gallery in Birmingham. Well, we're going to hear music, Mally, by Bach, Beethoven, some blues singing and whistling by Professor Longhair. But we're going to start with Vivaldi. Why this?
Well, I love the voice of the countertenors. I chose this one, Andrea Scholl, because I heard him sing this Vivaldi at a late night prom. It was a most wonderful concert. I'd taken a friend there and we were up in the gods, looking down, right down on the stage. And at the end of it all, the audience went wild. And I think I did too. I think we both did. The friend died not very long after that concert. And so it's a very poignant reminder of that night that we had there.
What is it about the countertenor voice, perhaps in terms of colour and light, given what your speciality is, that makes it so fascinating and in many ways different and otherworldly?
I'm not quite sure. I remember my mother saying once, "I do love an Italian tenor." And I thought she meant she'd met an Italian tenor. And I just have that love of this voice. Maybe it's the unexpectedness of it, the lightness, and often the purity.
Costa.
I love the sort of jauntiness of it, the way it keeps on going. And I sometimes play this when I get to the studio in the morning because it sort of livens me up, gets my circulation going.
We heard Nisi Dominus by Vivaldi, performed by Andreas Scholl and the Australian Brandenburg Orchestra, conducted by Paul Dyer. You were born in Wales, and some of your earliest memories, Mally, were by the sea, where I think your grandmother had created a caravan?
Yes, she did. She saw an advert in the local paper for a broken-down old bus, and she bought it, and the man who lived next door was a carpenter. He stripped it out under her instructions and put in bunk beds and a primer stove, and it was towed to the nearest seashore. We lived in Carnarvon at the time, so this was somewhere on the Menai Straits, just as it opened out into the Irish Sea. It was a very long time ago, but I do remember the walk from the caravan to the seashore. It was down a long lane with reeds on either side, almost like a tunnel. And then we came to the horizontal of a lane, which echoed the horizontal of the seashore, which echoed the horizontal of the horizon. And that shift towards, across, beyond, that kind of dance of space, I always remember.
Of course, for a painter, the combination of light and sea is very intoxicating, isn't it?
It is. It's the light, the reflection, but also the light filling the space, because there's nothing there above the sea other than sky and light.
And of course, as with the Vivaldi, it can be buoyant and jolly, or it can be ferocious and threatening, or can be completely still and calm.
Yes, I look down on, not the sea now, but from my studio, I look down at Deptford Creek, and that's different every minute, actually, of the day, and certainly one day from the next.
Your father was a Welsh speaker, and he introduced you to Welsh poetry?
He did. We didn't speak Welsh at home because my mother's mother lived with us, my grandmother, who I was very close to, and my mother wasn't fluent, but my father, I think, perhaps spoke Welsh before he spoke English. He was born at the foot of Snowdon, so lived in a beautiful, quite remote place. He loved poetry, and he did explain to me the intricacies of some of the forms, the poetic forms, the englyn, which is a three-line poem with very strict form to it, alliteration, and yet, when written well, seems flowing and effortless. That was what was fascinating.
You loved drawing from an early age, and I know you found your neighbour to be very enigmatic.
Yes, I didn't draw her. I was too young, I think, but I stared at her, which is actually close to drawing. I was no more than six, I think, living in Carnarvon in my grandmother's house, which was a terrace with a small garden at the front, and opposite was a sort of larger terrace, sort of posher. And through one of the windows that was directly opposite, I would often see a woman playing the piano, her back to the window. And this completely fascinated me. I didn't realise why at the time, but I think with hindsight, it was seeing a woman totally absorbed in something that wasn't domestic. It was creative. And I found out later that she was, in fact, composing at the piano. Dilys Elwyn Edwards, who is an eminent composer, mostly of song. I did write to her not that long ago, actually, a few years ago. I just wanted her to know how much it had meant to me.
Because you went walking with her too, didn't you?
Yes.
Up Snowdon.
Yeah, that was formative, I think. That was when I was older. And there was a hiking club, and she and her husband asked us if we'd like to go up Snowdon, by the light of the harvest moon to see the dawn, which seemed an amazing thing to do, and that's what we did. It was a real slog. But when we got to the top, it was extraordinary to watch it all unfolding. All the mountain ranges of Snowdonia sort of slowly, slowly came to light. I'd never seen as far as that ever. And the colours were really extraordinary. But on the way up, I saw Dilys, Elwyn Edwards, sort of breaking away from the group, not for any particular reason, I think. I saw her walking across a meadow, sort of striding across a meadow. And this image has stayed with me as vividly as that very spectacular dawn. And now I would say it's because it was seeing somebody on her own, away from the group, but sort of within reach, moving through the world. And that's space to me.
Well, we're not actually going to hear music by Dilys Elwyn Edwards, but we are going to hear a song of Wales, which is important to you. And you love the lyrics as well.
I do. It's called Arlanna Môr, which means on the seashore. And it's sung by Bryn Terfel, who my father didn't have his voice, but he had the same Welsh because they were born not that far away from each other. So this sounds like my father's Welsh. I love the sort of matter-of-factness of these lyrics. So he's describing his sweetheart as someone who sleeps at night and wakes in the morning, and I love the kind of ordinariness of that.
Alan Amor, On the Seashore, sung by Bryn Terfel and performed by the Welsh National Opera Orchestra, conducted by Gareth Jones. Did you learn any instruments at school?
I have to say I can't sing to save my life, really. And I did have piano lessons, not at school, but I think it was a relative of my father's. And I actually passed a couple of exams, but it left me. She and I didn't get on, but perhaps that was something to do with it. So, no. But I could tell you about something that happened when I was at school that really affected me a lot. I was watching a television programme and Paul Tourtellier came on playing Bach and Elgar, I think. And I was mesmerised by the playing and the sound of the cello and his face, his movements.
It was a rather extraordinary looking man, wasn't
he? He was, that long face and the intensity of it all. So I drew him in a little sketchbook, just very quick drawings. And then a couple of years later, I heard that he was playing at Bangor. And so I decided that I would go and see if he was around. I'm not sure what I had in mind, but I played truant and got on a bus and went to Bangor and found the place. There it was, an auditorium with a corridor outside. There was nobody around. Nothing like that would happen these days, I'm sure. And there was a window into the auditorium. And there he was practicing on stage. So I drew him through the window. And at one point he looked up and saw me and beckoned me in. So I sat in the front row while he rehearsed. And at the end of it all, there was still no one else around. He came over just to say hello. There wasn't a conversation, and signed one of the drawings, which I still have somewhere.
That's a lovely story. Now, although Tourtellier inspired this passion for the cello and cello music, you've actually chosen another cellist who is also important to you for other reasons.
Yes, Rostropovich. I love his playing. And I think one of the reasons that I've lately been so keen to listen to him even more was because a couple of years ago, my brother Ian sent me some writing that my father had submitted to his bank magazine. He worked in the bank. His fond memories of being the treasurer at the International Eisteddfod at Llangollen. This is not the Welsh one. It was really international, set up just after the war to give people hope, I think, in singing and dancing again. So he described his anxieties, that is, having enough foreign exchange money in this little bank for all the people that came from all over the world, but also the pleasures. And one of them was to hand out the checks, which they did in those days, to the star turns that appeared at the concerts at the end of the week. And I read, it sort of leapt off the page, exchanging pleasantries with Rostropovich. I thought this was wonderful. I didn't know my father had met Rostropovich.
So your allegiance on this recording of Bach has switched as a result from Tourtellier to Rostropovich, who of course also sums up for you a determination in the face of adversity.
Yes, his appearances at very historic moments, the prom in 1968, the Russian orchestra was playing with him as a soloist, and on the day of the prom, the news came through that Prague had been invaded. And there was a lot of discussion about whether they should go on with the concert because there were, in his memory, derisive catcalls, people telling him to go home, great anger, understandably. But they decided that they would carry on playing, and they played the Dvořák. And by all accounts, he wept all the way through and at the end held up the score in solidarity. And then as an encore, he said, "For those of you who are sad, I will now play Bach." And I was very moved when I saw a clip of him playing at when the Berlin Wall came down in 1989. He sat at Checkpoint Charlie to play Bach, to welcome people.
Well, let's listen to this piece, the prelude from the Cello Suite No. 1 by Bach, recorded live at the Prague Spring Festival in May 1955. We heard Mr. Slav Rostropovich playing music from the Cello Suite No. 1, recorded live at the Prague Spring Festival in May 1955. In 1963, you left Wales and headed to Newcastle University to study art. Were your parents supportive of this?
Well, they didn't know, I think, what it might involve. And I was also heading into the 60s, as well as to Newcastle, a big city, wonderful city. I fell in love with it. Mm. Actually, as soon as I crossed the Tyne, it was the beginning of adulthood.
And one of your first teachers was a remarkable pop artist.
Richard Hamilton, yes, he was.
Did you learn a lot from him?
It was a very cerebral course, and I think perhaps a lot of it went over my head, but it was the kind of teaching that comes back over the years.
You started experimenting with discs and colour, but Terry Frost, a leading abstract artist visiting from Cornwall, was a little bit sniffy.
It was a 2-week project where we were analysing an object that we owned, and I'd chosen my funny little swivelling mirror. I made the biggest work I'd ever made, 8x4, with some discs cut out and tilted at different angles. And I tried my oil paints out, but they didn't seem the right colour range. So I went to Woolworths and bought some household paints, little pots of pastel colours, and painted each disc a different colour. I thought it was pretty good. And I was sort of finishing it off when Terry, who had arrived a few days before his project, which was to start the following week, he stopped at my part of the studio and there was quite a long silence. And he said, "That's terrible colour. Where did you get it? Woolworths." And I said, "Yes." And at the same time, a senior student came in, just come back from New York, and he said, "That's a beautiful painting. It's American, it's contemporary, it's lovely. And so I didn't know what to think.
I didn't know which way to turn.
So later on that evening, I came back and painted out the colours in an act of destruction, really, I think. So I painted the top parts white, and that left the bright colour underneath. So these discs were casting these lovely coloured shadows and reflections in different ways. And I thought, well, I like that.
Very fascinating story, because it chimes with things I've experienced in music, which is that the wrong note is sometimes the right note, if you know what I mean. That actually what you achieved by trying to paint it out was a sort of synthesis, and you get something even newer.
I agree. I think the lesson was that some people like what you do and others don't, often for the same reasons. And we can't do without our wrong steps, I think.
Because the following week, Terry Frost had you experimenting with colour, didn't he? And you had something of an epiphany during that.
Yes, Terry asked us to bring in a flower. It was springtime, so I think it was a tulip or a daffodil, but I know it was yellow, very bright yellow. And he told us to mix our oil paints and try to get the colours that we saw whilst looking hard at this flower and put them down, but not describe the form, not describe the flower in any way. And after a while, this became, I mean, it's difficult to do, because the more you look, the more you see. And after a while, the dabs made a kind of rhythm across the paper and also made a kind of light. And this is still with me as something very important.
Is your next music something that in any way chimes with your feelings about painting and art?
This is Bob Dylan. I saw Bob Dylan go electric, I'm proud to say. When I tell younger people that, they think that must have been a long time ago. It was 1966 at Newcastle, 4 days after the concert at Manchester. And this was before mobile phones, and I'm not sure that we even knew about the cry of Judas that went up. We didn't know what to expect, and it was very wonderfully shocking. But what I'm really interested in these days is the way that he just likes to play his songs, sing his songs, and they're always different.
Well, that probably does chime with the way you work sometimes, an improvisatory reworking.
Yes, I think of it as my never-ending tour. You know, painting goes on. And actually, the phrase that often comes up is, what if I did it this way? Or what if I didn't do that? And that's not to disapprove of what came before. It's curiosity that there's something round the corner. A stinger of a series of dreams, when nothing comes up to the top, everything stays down but it's wounded. And come to a permanent stop. Wasn't thinking of anything specific, like in a dream where someone wakes up and screams. Nothing too very scientific. Just thinking of a series of dreams. Thinking of a series of dreams. Where the time and the tempo drag, and there's no exit in any direction. Except the one that you can't see with your eyes. Was it making any great connection? Was it folly or any intricate scheme? Nothing that would pass inspection.
surface was frozen. In another, I witnessed a crime. In one, I was running, and in another, all I seemed to be doing was climb. Wasn't looking for any special assistance, not going through any great extremes. I'd already gone the distance.
Bob Dylan's Series of Dreams, an outtake from O Mercy Sessions' Telltale Signs. And we heard the drums and percussion played by Roddy Colonna, and the talking drum, which was also an interesting thing to include, played by Cyril Neville. You're listening to Private Passions with me, Michael Barclay, and my guest today is the abstract artist Mally Morris. So when you got to Newcastle, Mally, what was the atmosphere there like? And were there other women with you on the course?
I think it was pretty even, but not on the staff. Rita Donner was a wonderful teacher. She quoted from Paul Klee's notebooks a lot. I remember that being really helpful.
Taking a line for a walk.
Yes. And I think it was around that time that I started to notice that there were women painters that I liked a lot. Gillian Ayres, Prunella Clough. And perhaps it was around then that I thought, well, this is what I'm doing.
You started working very noticeably with geometric shapes, triangles, circles.
Yes, that's true. They're not meaningful to me in any way other than how useful they are in the whole kind of orchestration of the painting. They don't represent anything in particular, but of course they make a form and a dynamic.
They make the colour travel.
Exactly. Mm. In and out and across and through.
We're going to hear Beethoven next. Could hardly be more contrasting from the Bob Dylan we've just heard. This is the extraordinary cavatina in B-flat major, played, interestingly, by the great Talik string quartet. What does this music say to you?
I think it's almost impossible to put into words, actually. I find it so mysterious what feelings it provokes. There's comfort in it, but also discomfort.
And it's kind of disturbing comfort.
Yes, I would say so. I don't think there's disharmony. I don't hear the clash of that. It's almost like the closeness of one mood to another, so that they almost become the same. And so it keeps me completely in the moment of listening. I'm sort of swept along with that contradiction, and also that becomes beautiful.
Thank you.
The Cavatina from Beethoven's String Quartet No. 130 in B-flat major, performed by the Tallich String Quartet. You've been painting over 60 years, and has your love of it stayed consistently strong? Do you sometimes doubt yourself, or does your imagination keep you going?
Doubt is important, I think, as is a certain amount of confidence, and one, I don't know, perhaps ricochets between the two.
Well, like that early experience you had in the studio with Terry Frost and the other
That's
person.
Right. It's all in there, because if you're trying things out, they may not work. And I think a few people say this, that you leave the studio thinking that what you've done is pretty good, and you come back the next day and it isn't at all.
Cold light of day is a very harsh judge.
And then surprises happen, and you try something that really seems to have come out of the blue. It's come from in you somewhere, and that's the thing that you need to do.
Do you listen to music when you paint?
Yes, I do, most of the time. Sometimes it's the radio, and other times I have sort of passions for one composer or one singer that last, you know, a couple of days or even a week.
Do they influence the brushstroke, as it were, if you're listening to a very furious Beethoven piece? do your strokes become
more animated? I don't think so.
No.
I mean, it's true that I might put something on, like the Vivaldi that we played at first, that might liven me up. Or I like the bootleg CDs of Dylan, because they remind me of kind of what improvisation could do. And jazz, I haven't got any jazz today, but I do listen to that.
And this next piece of music is actually about a painter, isn't it?
Yes. So Jonathan Richman was an art student in the 70s in Boston, I think, and moved to New York to be near the Velvet Underground. I think a lot of people move to somewhere to be near their heroes or the people they want to be like. And he did form his own band, Modern Lovers, and had hits. But it's the later part of his career that I'm really keen on. My partner, Steve, he's actually my husband, but we were partners for 39 years and married recently in July.
So congratulations.
Thank you. I'm not used to saying the word husband, but we would go to hear him. We've also heard him in New York, and the last time we heard him was in a pub in New Cross. So I love the intimacy of his songs. He now plays just with a drummer, Tommy Larkins, great drummer. And his songs, some people would describe as maybe even whimsical, but I think they're very pure and true in their feeling. If you're sitting on a bus and somebody comes to sit next to you and says something rather startling and you feel a little bit nervous, but then they go on to say wise and interesting things, that's what I think his songs are like.
And it's called No One Was Like Vermeer.
I love this about Vermeer. He does sing about other painters, Picasso, Dali, but he was a painter, Jonathan Richman, and he loves painting. And so these all ring true. They sound like he knows what he's talking about.
Back in the days of Rembrandt, back in the time of old Jahnstein, all of them giants of shadow and light, but no one was like Vermeer. Some paint and smell of joy and sweat, some paint and plain look so fine, some paintings are sad and passionate, but Vermeer sends a chill up your spine. Yeah, Vermeer sends a chill up your spine. Vermeer was eerie, Vermeer was strange. He had a more modern color range, as if born in another age, like maybe 100 or so years ago. What's this, a ghost in the gallery? Great Scott, the Martians are here. These strange little paintings next to the others, no one was like Vermeer. it was eerie, for me it was weird. He had his own way of doing things with the paint from another era, another era.
No One Was Like Vermeer by Jonathan Richmond with Tommy Larkins from the album Because Her Beauty Is Raw and Wild. Mally, you've taught art for many years, and I wonder how you feel about the current provision of art in schools.
Well, I'm very worried about it. I think it's a really serious situation. I was born just after the war, and so was in that generation. A grant took me to university. I even had a grant for going to research paintings that I was writing my thesis about. And I thought that was for all of us forever. And the sort of shrinking of availability of good teaching of art and music, I think it's disastrous, actually.
I mean, one has to point out that the economy is in a very bad way and things do have to give. How would you put it right in terms of art and music? Is there a way of doing that without actually just spending millions and millions more?
I don't know the answer to that. I mean, we do in our community at the studios do our bit, the more people that do their bit. But I think that really the arts are an essential part of a curriculum, just as important as maths and language.
Bach again, but rather different this time because we're going to hear Bach on the piano.
Yes, I was waiting for my ride home on a rainy day from the studio, and Steve has this studio on the ground floor where the sculptors work in our building. So I walked in and this was on the radio, and it just stopped me dead in my tracks and I couldn't move until the end of it. I understand it was the BBC lockdown project to have Víkingur Ólafsson contribute something once a week.
He's a very gifted pianist, and here he plays Bach's Widerstehe durch der Sünde, BWV 54.
Thank you.
I think that was another wonderful example of looking at an old piece from a different angle, not exactly reworking it, but it really suits the piano as played there, doesn't it? Stand firm against sin. Do not let Satan blind you. I think hearing that, Satan would turn on his heels. Go the other way. Bach's Widerstehe durch der Zünder, performed by Vikinga Olafsson. One of your most public works of art, Mally Morris, were the flags which bedecked Bond Street last year. And I wonder how you felt seeing your work floating up in the air as opposed to being simply on a wall.
Well, it was a very new experience. I was invited to do it by the Royal Academy. There's a tradition now of an academician being invited to put up the design, I suppose, the banners for Piccadilly and Bond Street. I was glad it was Bond Street because that's more contained. It was three across and 11 rows down. And when I was first asked, I actually said, I'm not sure about that, because it felt like a design project. And I've nothing against design. It's just that it's different from painting. And I'm so sort of touchy about the properties of painting being seen, surface, touch, layers, transparencies and so on. So I said I'd call back the next day, and I told Steve about this, and he said, of course you'll do it. Knowing me perhaps better than I know myself, he said, you love colour up in the air, bunting and balloons and kites and fireworks and so on. And so I thought I'd have a go, and it was very interesting because I made them as paintings on paper to scale. Small. I mean, the actual banners or flags are 12 foot by 6 foot. And I wasn't going to be seeing them until they were up in the air, when it would be too late to do anything about anything. And the day was set. I wasn't going to see that. They do that overnight. But I thought, well, I'll go up and have a look. But in fact, they went up a couple of days earlier. And a friend who works at the Academy sent me a photograph, and I thought it was the computer mock-up. It was exactly, exactly as I had planned. So I was really thrilled.
Your current exhibition is at Icon in Birmingham. You had your first ever solo show with them back in 1979, so it must be curious to be back.
It's been lovely, actually. It was curated by Sam Cornish, who's written about my work. And it's very interesting to see early work with very recent work.
Composers often have terrible problems with titles. They're almost more difficult than writing the music. Do you ever have that problem with paintings?
It can be agony, yeah. Sometimes they come easily. Sometimes they're fairly mundane. I title works when they're finished.
Debussy did that too. Some of the water music, he did it afterwards, which always surprises me.
I didn't know that. I like that. The titles are not descriptions, but they're sort of invitations into the painting or the print. So I'd finish this print, and there were small circles in it, different colours, and the word Tiddlywinks came to mind, but I didn't like that as a title. And that reminded me of a song from the 60s by Alan Toussaint called Tiddlywinks, but that was too literal. And so I called the print Toussaint in honour of him. And then through him found Professor Longhair, the maestro in New Orleans. So I bought this album, Live at the Queen Mary, which is fantastic. And one of the songs on it is Mardi Gras in New Orleans. But what I especially like about it is it has whistling in it. I love whistling. I can't whistle myself. But people don't seem to whistle like they used to, or at least not as tunefully. A couple of weeks ago, there was a couple walking towards me, and he was a really good whistler. As they passed me, I couldn't stop myself. I turned around and followed them so I could hear more of it. Not for very long, but...
You stalked him.
I did.
Well, we're going to stalk Professor Longhair now with Mardi Gras in New Orleans from the album Live, as you said, on the Queen Mary. So it only remains for me to say, Mally Morris, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. but you're going too lonely. You ought to go see the mighty girl. You know, if you're going too lonely, you ought to go see the mighty girl. You know, when you see the mighty girl, somebody'll tell you what's kind of been wrong. You will see the Zulu King down on St. Claude and Dumaine. You will see the Zulu King down on St. Claude and Dumaine. Down by the old auditorium is where you'll wait to see the
Mardi Gras in New Orleans by Professor Longhair from the album Live on the Queen Mary. The final choice of Michael Barclay's guest today on Private Passions, the abstract painter Mally Morris. The programme was produced by Claire Walker. Next week, Michael will be talking to the author Daniel Handler, better known by his pen name Lemony Snicket. This is BBC Radio 3. On 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio, on BBC Sounds, and on most smart speakers. Just ask for BBC Radio 3. It's just coming up to 1 o'clock, and it's time for the news, read by me, Amanda Litherland. A 2-minute silence has been held across the UK to remember the contribution of military and civilian servicemen and women in the First and Second World Wars and other conflicts. The King led the National Service of Remembrance at the Cenotaph in central London, where he laid the first wreath. Other members of the royal family and senior politicians also laid wreaths. The Prime Minister is facing growing calls from Labour to sack the Home Secretary after she was accused of stoking tensions before yesterday's pro-Palestinian march in central London. Suella Braverman had called those demonstrating in support of Gaza hate marches. The Defence Secretary, Grant Shapp, says it was perfectly proper for Ms Braverman to enter the debate about policing on Remembrance Weekend. The Metropolitan Police said the vast majority of the 126 arrests it made yesterday were counter-protesters. Hamas says the cardiac ward at the Al-Shifa hospital in Gaza has been destroyed by an Israeli airstrike. Israel's military has denied deliberately targeting the facility. The World Health Organization says it's lost communication with the site and is gravely concerned. The Rafah crossing, which is the only way out of Gaza, has reopened for the first time since Thursday. It means some foreign passport holders can travel to Egypt. Security sources say about 80 of them have crossed the border and a small number of injured Gazans were taken to Egyptian hospitals. Rescue workers in northern India are trying to reach around 40 construction workers trapped inside a tunnel which partly collapsed as they were working on it. Huge piles of concrete are thought to be blocking the tunnel entrance in the Himalayan state of Uttarakhand. Emergency teams are piping oxygen to the workers through narrow gaps in the rubble. Scientists say seismic activity has decreased on the Reykjanes Peninsula in southwest Iceland, where hundreds of people have had to leave their homes over fears about a volcanic eruption. A state of emergency is still in place in the region, and experts stress a long river of magma running underneath the peninsula is still active. England have included just 6 members of their Cricket World Cup squad for a 3-match one-day series against West Indies next month. England's men, who were defending champions, failed to make the semi-finals. The omissions include England's leading run scorer at the tournament, David Mullen, and the vice-captain, Moeen Ali. And the weather. Cloud and spells of rain will push north-eastwards throughout the afternoon, reaching southern Scotland by the evening. There'll be brighter skies elsewhere, but it'll turn breezy later on today. Highs of 10 degrees in London and Belfast, 8 in Edinburgh and 12 in Cardiff. BBC News at 1:02.
BBC Radio 3 at the London Jazz Festival 2023.
Join me, Jamokhair Fashola, for Jazz Voice, a celebration of song featuring an array of stars, including Emily Sandé and Clark Peters. You can also join me for the J2Z launch party, along with Radio 1 Extras, Cascade, and some great live music.
BBC Radio 3 at the London Jazz Festival.
Listen now, just